employer matching.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, who really pays the price for failing go-go bank out bailouts? We're going to look into that with Greg Palast. Also remembering Cinco de Mayo, even as Biden sends 1,500 U.S. troops to the Mexican-U.S. border at the end of Title 42. We're going to take a close look at that as well. And meanwhile, thousands of asylum seekers desperate for relief and a hearing gathered by the thousands on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. And we'll also take a look at, well, yeah, tracking the racist murders of indigenous women. This is an incredibly important story, and today is a special day devoted to that. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. And we are coming to you live from KPFA in the Bay Area. Thanks for joining us. Great to have you along. Well, you may have heard the prosecutor investigating possible illegal meddling in the 2020 election in Georgia has agreed to immunity deals with at least 8 Republican fake electors who signed a certificate falsely stating that then-President Donald Trump had won the state. And there's also 2 other folks who accepted a deal. That's the deal that really might get on Donald Trump's case, wouldn't you say, Greg?
Yes, indeed. Greg Palast here. Election crimes never stop. But the good news is for justice is that 8 of the people that were targets of Fannie Willis, that's the prosecutor in Atlanta, these are the 8 of the electors, that is, of the fake electors. These are people who submitted their names saying that they had won election as electors to the Electoral College. As you know from third grade civics, we don't vote for president, we vote for electors. The problem is that these electors were never elected. They were never even on the ballot. But they had their names submitted. Now, since the mails were used to submit their names, it actually goes to the National Archives, and it was supposed to go from there to Mike Pence, to open the envelopes on January 6th, as we should know by now. They never got elected anything, so this is a fraud. This is a felony crime. But Fannie Willis knows that these so-called electors, they're just like local schmokels. You know, they're the local baker, the local pharmacist right. down in Athens, Georgia, or down in Forsyth County or whatever. They are not arch criminals. In fact, it's very clear that they were told by Rudy Giuliani and they were told by the head of the Republican Party and a state senator that this is all quite legal, that they're just putting in their names in case Trump wins his case in federal court or state court overturning the results in Georgia. That would preserve his electoral votes. The problem is that's a crime. And so Fannie offered them immunity. What immunity means is that you have to tell the truth if you accept the immunity agreement. So that's trouble for those who, in what they could testify at, unless they shock us and say that Donald Trump personally called them to sign on as fake electors. I don't think that this is going to harm Trump at all. What will it does, though, threaten Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell. It threatens certainly the head of the Republican Party, Schaefer, in Georgia, and as well a Georgia state senator, because they're the ones who assured these people everything is legal, and of course it isn't. So they've accepted immunity. Now, the danger for the GOP, especially Trump, Giuliani, and friends, those eight who agreed to immunity still are using the lawyers provided by the Republican Party. So they're kind of trying to get them to get all their stories together and not implicate each other. But two have run off the ranch, including head of the Republican Party in Coffee County. Now, Coffee,
yes.
where I was down there reporting from Douglas, it's in my film Vigilante, Coffee County, which is a strong Republican stronghold, the head of the party there not only was an elector, but agreed to, help them get tapes from the county clerk, the voting machine tapes. Now, remember, when we say voting machines, there's only paper ballots in Georgia, but the machines tally them. You do have scanners which keep the tally, and they're trying to prove that those tally machines, which were provided by Dominion systems, were somehow rigged. They got the tapes. There was no indication that there was any rigging at all, but conning an agency, a government agency, into giving you what might include information to identify particular voters and votes, that's a no-no. That's a serious crime under state law. So the fact that the Republican leader of Coffee County is getting her own lawyer and indications are she will take the immunity. That's real problems for the GOP. I should note that those tapes might actually be public documents. But if you want such documents, you have to do what I did for Flashpoint, which is I filed a Freedom of Information Request Act. And when the state refused, I went to federal court and got a court judgment. I didn't figure out how to, like, break into the office or hack the computer. That's a crime.
Right.
That's a crime. Or if you so I don't commit crimes to get the information, but apparently Rudy Giuliani, despite being a former prosecutor, didn't understand.
Right, he didn't get
court.
It.
He didn't get the memo. Or he thought he was immune because he thought Donald Trump would probably grant him a pardon for crimes he was in the midst of committing.
Well, he thought he had the right hair polish, but then he realized under the heat.
Well,
listening to Flesh. Hold on, let me jump in here. Greg, I want to apologize. I forgot to tell people on your last name, which is Palast. We're speaking with Greg Palast. You can check him out at gregpalast.com. We've been doing the Election Crimes Bulletin for a long time. This isn't that, but we wanted to... Greg is also a very skilled financial reporter, so I wanted to grab him on a on this issue because it was just breaking in terms of the DA in Atlanta. But, Greg, we're pressed for time, and I wanted to also get to you on the banking stuff. And it is disgusting. There's no reporting on the way in which, once again, the middle class, the working class, is going to get brutalized to bail out rich people. But this is just a couple of lines from AP, and
right.
let me jump in, Greg.
And by the way, I don't do this at home. I'm a trained economist. I lectured at London School of Economics and Cambridge University Department of Applied Economics. So let me tell you, I've talked to several economists who actually are real economists, not like Powell, not politicians, who all said the same thing. What the heck is this guy doing raising interest rates once again? It's punishing the victims. First of all,
absolutely,
the entire press, right to left, New York Times to Wall Street Journal, Fox News to MSDNC, I don't care, they all said the same thing. The danger is that employment is rising. And if we don't cool off the jobs market, and let me translate, that means throwing about 1.5 million people out of work. If we don't throw people out of work and reduce wages, then we're going to have terrible inflation. Everyone seems to agree with that, except for the economists I've spoken to, and not one PhD has said that this makes any sense, because we have, as the great economist Naomi Prince says, this is a supply squeeze inflation, not demand pull. I mean, let me give you a couple quick numbers. In the past 2 years, a $100 basket of your typical purchase items now costs $114. We've had 14% inflation over 2 years. 14%. The average salary, yes, has gone up. The average production worker salary has gone up by 9.5%. What that comes down to is that the average worker has lost $4,000 a year in purchasing power. Your wages have gone up $3.71 an hour, including benefits.
Right.
I know you're living high on that, Dennis, the $3.71 an hour.
Oh, yeah.
And then in addition, but you're falling behind. So you can't be a wage push or an employment push inflation. It is caused by the way, apparently Powell didn't know that there was an invasion of Ukraine, which caused oil prices to jump through the roof. Ukraine is also one of the largest exporters of grains and edible oil, so there goes food. China, America's biggest port, which is Shanghai, not Los Angeles, but Shanghai, shut down because of COVID, and that caused a tremendous drop in supplies of particularly low-end chips that we need for cars. So we literally had 1.3 million cars could not be made in the United States because of a lack of chips. When you lose that much supply, auto prices for used cars went through the roof. That's 8% of our consumer price index. I know it's a lot of numbers, but basically it comes down to this. The average worker is the victim of this inflation, not its
cause.
And you cannot bring down this inflation, a supply squeeze inflation, unless, number one, you increase supplies. By the way, let's start with ending the embargo on Venezuela, the world's largest reserves of oil. That would make a huge difference. Instead of taking their foot off Venezuela's neck, they're putting their foot on the workers' neck, and that won't do it. And by the way, just one quick thing for those of you who took Econ 101, you probably remember something called the Phillips curve, in which they told you that rising employment will lead to rising prices and inflation. Well, as that's what this is all based on, is this so-called Phillips curve. But as Powell's own economists issued a paper last year saying, quote, the Phillips curve is dead. It's dead. Stop relying on this thing because it's hurting workers, and that's not the cause of inflation. That's his own economist, and he told his own economist to go fly. We're still going to stick it to the working class.
Now, Greg, we're just about out of time, but I want you to make this point. Every time there's a bailout like this, it becomes a shift from of wealth from the working class and the middle class, and you can hear the sucking upwards, right? Because we really are, the people really are, the workers are really paying for the bailout. And these guys do it again and again.
Well, here's a quick number that you need to know. Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon's bank, made $13 billion in profit in the first 3 months of the year, more than they've made in their entire existence. Wow. Because of the rising interest rates. Not everyone gets hurt by interest rates. Not everyone gets hurt by inflation. They're raking it in. Chevron and ConocoPhillips both reported the best year they've had in their 135-year histories in terms of profits, massive profits. So you got profiteering by oil companies. And by the way, I would note that in England, the so-called conservative government imposed a 25% windfall profits tax on energy companies because they say it's war profiteering. Prices are going up because of the war in Ukraine. It's not because they're finding a better sales pitch.
Yeah.
Right. It's war profiteering. And at least in England, they're charging a war profiteering tax on energy companies.
That's a good idea.
Let me just mention, next week, Dennis, I'm going to have a special conversation for Flashpoint listeners with economist Nomi Prince, where we're going to break it down in detail. It'll be
beautiful.
Fun, and you'll enjoy it, I promise.
We're looking forward to that, and we'll let people know exactly when it's going to be. Greg Palast, yep. GregPalast.com. Check out the film Vigilantes. Go there. You'll learn a lot. Greg, thanks for coming with us today. We appreciate it.
You're the best, Dennis. Thank you so much. Bye.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to deal with, among other things, the ongoing murders. This has been going on for a while, of indigenous women. This is a terrible situation, and Sarah Blanco is going to help us understand more about it on this very special day devoted to thinking about these victims of white supremacy. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, today is a special day, and here to tell us about it is a wonderful reporter and producer at KPFA Pacifica Radio. Sarah Blanco, welcome back to Flashpoints. It is really good to have you as a contributor here. And tell us about today. Tell us about these women. Tell us about how long this has been going on.
Hi, Dennis, and hello, listeners. I'm glad to be here to talk about this. You know, I think the first thing I want to say is that the loved ones and the advocates of those who are missing or that were murdered have really been leading the efforts and first receive the acknowledgement, because the loved ones and advocates going back as far as colonization of these lands, right, had been fighting for this, and some are no longer alive to see how much progress is being made. And I just hate to think how hard so many people have had to fight for their loved ones and to get any help at all.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons, you know, that you're... Yeah, go ahead.
No, go on, please.
I think one of the reasons you're having me is because I have had the opportunity to have some loved ones who have had people missing or who were murdered. We've had conversations, so, you know, as a reporter, I try to let people tell those stories. And, you know, they're raw and it's overwhelmingly sad. But I think a little bit later on, we can also talk about how we can all do our part. I want to start by mentioning that.
go right ahead. Absolutely. You got the floor.
And so some of the events that have been happening lately, so this recent week at the Capitol in Sacramento, I didn't get the chance to attend, but there were a lot of events. And so it was the first time that they lit the Capitol Dome in red in honor of missing and murdered Indigenous women and peoples. There was also a candlelight vigil. And then Assemblymember James Ramos, of course, with a lot of advocacy groups who have been doing this work for a long time and are really the boots on the ground, so to speak, they talked specifically about ACR 25 as well, which passed Assembly to make it to try to get May 5th as a remembrance to missing and murdered Indigenous people. And then President Joe Biden actually signed into law a national day recognizing missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so in that proclamation, if you will, he says that he wants to call on all Americans and ask all levels of government to support tribal governments and tribal communities and their efforts to increase awareness of the issue. And so I really, when I read that, I think, okay, this is great. This can make it more mainstream. And the reality is how is that going to trickle down now toward the people who we're supposed to trust and go to when we want justice, such as like police forces, or if you're in the military, who are you supposed to trust? And but I think that on the national level, that those things are amazing. But I think that advocates have really already had, like, for example, May 5th was already like, the National, I believe, Red Dress Day, right? So there are all of these ways to remember loved ones. And if you haven't had a chance to kind of look at a lot of those events, one good place to look would be Restorative Justice for Indigenous Communities. Our colleague Morningstar runs that. And there's a variety of places that will tell you, you know, who's missing right now, who has been murdered, and it's unsolved, and nobody's doing anything about it. And I think that's one way that we can kind of do our part. Because we just can't
talk a little bit. Talk a little bit more about the way, the dangers that women face. I mean, you meant to mention military bases, and we have seen horrific situations, and there's inactivity. There's no real response from the military. But talk a just. To keep a human face on it, well, who are some of the people? Are there women missing now? How does this manifest? How do people find out, you know, what happened to their loved ones? Or what's that look like?
There's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there. I would think that, like, when I was talking about, like, okay, well, what can we do? We can't depend on the mainstream media. I would say that, like, when we watch or listen or read our news, when we commune in our neighborhoods, when we travel on vacation, we can stop and research, is there someone that I could help who's suffering a loss right now? One of the things that, like, when children go missing, right, there's Amber Alerts, right, and that's touted as something, is one way to get children back right away. But historically, when women, people of color, are ignored when they go missing, or they're always just kind of told, like, oh, they just must be runaways, or you go to, you know, the authorities and they don't care, clearly you're losing precious time. So a lot of efforts to try to get alerts available. So, and getting the community involved, right? If I'm sitting at home doing nothing and I see an alert, I'm going to go run out and look for a child. Why can't I get an alert that there's a woman missing, that there's a person of color missing, that anybody's missing, really? But I think that's one way. There are a lot of murders as well that go unsolved, and there are some really incredibly heinous situations when you start to hear what the loved ones have to say. I'd like to, you know, say some names when we're done. Yes. When I think of Jessica Alva and talking to her mother, some of the situations that were encountered there, very, very triggering potentially for some people, what I'm about to say, very, very drastic, but bruised and beaten and found hanging in her apartment. And the police let the people who were there go free despite a very strong smell of bleach. And her mother has tirelessly been working to, I mean, imagine just that in and of itself, right? And so these are the kinds of stories that happen. That was San Francisco, right? So and not too long ago. So they're not great, but if we have that time and energy and we can, you know, ask a loved one, what can I do, right? They might not want anything. You know, they might want you to tell a story. They might want food. They might want you to help search. You should take it seriously.
Given what we know, it's safe to say, funny way to say it, that the military is a very dangerous place for Indigenous women to be, right? This has proved a real problem, and the military is virtually unresponsive.
Yeah, and that really goes back to the structure of the military as well. So when Vanessa Guillen was murdered, right, it sparked an entire Me Too movement, right? And really, so many people came out, so to speak, but many of them had said something before, right, and nobody listened. The structure there was, we're here to do one thing, and as Joy Damiani says, and that might be to be a robot, right? And to do as we're told. And so the very structure of that and of war, right, creates an entire system. And then you have this whole idea of the way that women and people of color were treated when the land was colonized. And so within the military, they have tried to do so many different things, right? They have, like, SHARPS. They say that they have all of these presentations and such. But constantly we hear these stories of people who are, you know, dead in their barracks, go missing and are found later, or they find the body of somebody else while they were looking for someone else. There's just a repetitive nature. I personally Mexicana and Latina, and so we know that, was there a border, right? And so when you think about these lands and you think about the violence over there on that so-called border and the violence here, there's too much that's being swept under the rug, so to speak. And I think we can all do something.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Sarah Blanco, and we're talking about a situation that's been going on for some time now. We're talking about the really racist murders of Indigenous women, and it happens in a lot of different ways. We also see these extractors, these companies, these huge companies moving into small towns with lots of men. And that becomes problematic, right?
Right. And so when I've worked with Morningstar in the past, which is how I kind of got started reporting with, on the stories of loved ones, talking about those prison camps, like not a lot of people were talking about that, but really connecting the dots. Just think about what's happening when people are going into what bit of land there is left for tribal communities, taking everything they can. But then something else is happening as well, right? Where are the women going? Where are the youth going? What's happening to them in this process, right? And they get to go back. The labor camps, or not labor camps, but, we can call them man camps, if you will, right? They're there for a period of time, and then they go back, and they go back to their homes. And if you're living in a small community, you may not always be able to speak out. And so when we think about, like, okay, well, no drilling, yeah, we want to protect Mother Earth, but also it's like you're to have to protect your children, your family, your loved ones. It's terrible. It's not something that ended just with industrialization, if you will. Like, okay, genocide happened, they tried to kind of wash that all under the rug, and then America keeps going. Yeah, but those same things are happening, little microcosms all over the place. It's disgusting.
And it really is, Sarah, the same sort of, it's a similar or parallel experience with the U.S. military bases and these man camps.
Yeah.
It's the same devastation.
Yeah.
One is a directly a result of corporate infiltration, and obviously the other is military. And certainly, if you're in the military, you're not training to save Native American communities. That's for sure. So this is deep, isn't it? This is really something that has to be dealt with straight ahead.
Yeah, and then, you know, then there's the idea of, you know, I think there's a lot of, like, apology that people give that's unwarranted, like, such as, like, oh, you know, we're sorry this is happening, but kind of, you know, take care of yourselves, right? Well, it's like, where is the funding for that? Where we know that not every community is treated equally, and right, and then if you were to depend on a police force in your area, like, how many are there, right? And right. Are the police the perpetrators, right? And in what way?
Right. Wow.
A myriad of ways, potentially. Yeah.
Well, listen, I know that you're gonna be staying with this story, and there's a lot more to say about it and a lot more reporting to do about it. Sarah, we always appreciate the visit, and this story is crucial to us, so we know you're going to come back and continue to keep it alive and help our audience understand that this is going on now. It's virtually unreported in the mainstream. And so, again, we thank you for making it part of your beat.
Thank you, Dennis. If I may say the name of just some of those on my mind today.
Yes.
Jessica Alva, Bessie Walker, Nicole Smith, Khadijah Britton, Angela McConnell, and so many more. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you. And we'll continue. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk about Cinco de Mayo, the history, and why it's important to a certain group of folks on the Flashpoints team besides this entire community and this hemisphere. Stay with us. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, we've got two very special guests for the show now. It's Cinco de Mayo. We're going to find out what that is, why we are celebrating today. And joining us to do it is somebody you may have heard of. His name is Miguel Gavilán Molina, Yaqui Chicano, proud of it. And also joining us is another sort of, you know, visitor to the show from time to time, Francisco Herrera, the wonderful troubadour, organizer, defender of human rights, and lots of other stuff. Welcome to Flashpoints, Miguel, Francisco. Miguel, take it. Cinco de Mayo, why is this an important day?
Well, Dennis, it commemorates the Mexican, collective efforts gathering a nation to repel the invasion of the French. A lot of times most people think that Cinco de Mayo, commemorates the independence of Spanish rule. But that happens in September the 16th of a rebellion led by Father Miguel Hidalgo de Castilla that started on September 16th, 1819. And 11 years later, gained independence from Spain. But Cinco de Mayo commemorates the victorious battle in the war that Mexico had with, the invading forces of France. And today, a lot of people think that, it was the victory, it was the independence. It wasn't. The French came back about a year later, and they actually were able to take Mexico. And that battle, that effort, lasted. It lasted like 4 years, and finally, they were able to come together and repel the French under the leadership of President Benito Juarez, that had fled the country but returned. But one of the things that I think is really important, Benito Juarez was a full-blooded Zapoteco Indian. And Mexico was in a devastating, situation. They had not recovered from the 11-year war against the Spaniards. And they were in debt. And they went into debt and borrowed money from France. They borrowed money from Spain. They borrowed money from England, to be able to survive. Well, as we know, a lot of things that happened back in that time are even happening today. And one of the things that the presidency of Benito Juarez had to deal with is that, he was forced to suspend payment to foreign banks and keep the money in the country because people were starving. I mean, it was mass, famine throughout Mexico. Poverty was extreme. You couldn't pay back the loans, could barely pay back the interest. Well, Benito Juarez decided he just couldn't. He stopped the payments, and that's what opened up the doors for the French coming to collect. It's almost the same thing that happens today, Dennis and Francisco, with World Bank policies, that are just, coming into countries that are in debt, coming into countries that are in conflict or turmoil, and then, taking those countries, giving those countries loans, knowing full well that those countries will not be able to pay. So Cinco de Mayo celebrates our resistance. It celebrates, regardless of the invading forces of the French, we were able to repel them. And it's a victory because in the Mexican and Chicano consciousness, there's hardly any victories that we can look to outside of this 16 Septiembre. And, of course, a lot of us find ourselves here in the United States under colonial rule in the Southwest. As a Chicano, today, I recognize Cinco de Mayo, as a day of celebration because we were able to repel the French. But like I said, they came back a year later and they took Mexico and installed an Emperor Maximilian, an Austrian, who was the nephew to Napoleon Bonaparte, who at that time, was raging, trying to conquer Europe. But I think one of the things as a Chicano, as an indigenous person today, this tradition of Cinco de Mayo started back in the late 60s. And it's evolved to become sort of like a national indigenous Latino Pride Day. And this week was significant. Today, we, as Chicanos, we have this collective spiritual consciousness to the indigenous peoples, throughout what we called Anahuac, throughout Aztlan, throughout this hemisphere, America. And we're in solidarity with tribal nations and tribal groups. And today, Cinco de Mayo, I raised my fist and I also raised my head to the sun, to the sky, to the stars, you know, and we are recognizing it as a Red Dress Day for all our indigenous women that have been victims of, you know, violence, untold violence covered up, violence, you know, that this society is in denial of. And it is something that I took a knee today and I raised my fist to the sky to the women, the indigenous women that have kept our culture and our heritage alive, again, throughout the hemisphere. Because in indigenous lands, there are no borders. Those were concepts and ideas brought in by the Euros that invaded these lands. And so today, I've always done it on Cinco de Mayo, and I'm going to take a quick break here and yell it out. A rebel yell, el grito de Cinco de Mayo. Francisco, ¿cómo estás, compañero?
Francisco, welcome. Go.
Wow. Thank you for that rebel yell, hermano. That's great.
Well, Francisco, can I ask you to Francisco, can I just throw this out as you focus, and I would love to hear your response to Cinco de Mayo, but does it have is there a certain poignancy given the fact that you've got U.S. troops heading to the border and the kind of violence that we've seen at the border? It seems to me that in terms of liberation, Cinco de Mayo could be a focus point.
Well, it's funny you read my mind, Dennis, because Gavilan did such a wonderful synopsis and summary in a great way. I thought, and it would take it 160 years now from that date of 1862, or 61 now, that is 23. You know, Cinco de Mayo, groups of practically unarmed indigenous people from the land that faced what at that time was the wealthiest, strongest army in the world, France. And I couldn't help, as Gavilan was talking and thinking about, you know, a group of practically unarmed mass of folks facing this big army. And, you know, U.S. foreign policy has pretty much burned the house to our south, you know, to our neighbors in the south, with all these baloney politics that have destroyed life in Latin America. And now you have exactly that. Unarmed masses of people are saying, look, you've destroyed life in our house. You've burnt our house down. And all we can do is come here. And that's basically what has happened. It's like a mass nonviolent movement of people that are saying, we can't, you know, we can't deal with these foreign policies, bank policies, violent policies. You've created a drug war in what was, you know, land that we could live off, and NAFTA destroyed any chance that we could live from the earth in terms of trade and markets. All we can do is now start walking, and that's what people are doing. And now facing 1,500 troops, you know, with saying that they're going to come do database. What is it? The general said they're going to come do data entry. And but so it's not exactly the same, but it's just the story of unarmed people getting together and taking a stand and moving, you know, and changing the world, changing the society, changing history. It's very amazing what's going on with the caravans, and it's horrible that instead of the U.S. recognizing, oh yes, we burnt our neighbor's house down, we destroyed it with NAFTA, we destroyed it with the whole drug trade, having to have shit up our nose, and you know, so people are making billions of dollars from this drug trade, and we can't recognize it. Instead of creating appropriate policies, instead of saying, this money that would fund 1,500 troops, let's make it to help process people who are coming with legitimate claims for political asylum. I'm telling you, in Mexico alone, we're seeing 22 to 30 people every single day are murdered right now, tomorrow, the day after, and yesterday. So just to make it short, it's amazing to me, the movement of people and the horrific response that Biden the Biden administration. I mean, Trump could probably not get away with this stuff. But here we go. You know, it's like it's a Democrat, just like Obama was a Democrat who created the first jails for the teenagers that were coming back in 2014. So it's horrific to see that instead of saying yes, NAFTA destroyed, gatekeeper created these horrible situations, our policies have destroyed many lands of Latin America, and that's why people are coming. We were told that back in the 1990s, that this exactly was going to happen. Now let's do the appropriate thing. No, we can't do the appropriate thing. Just like an addict, we find the excuse and we get the army out of the border.
Well, Miguel, you want to jump in?
Oh, absolutely, Dennis and Francisco. The situation that's happening right now is unbelievable. The world is watching this situation at the border between Mexico and the United States. And when you mobilize the U.S. Armed Forces, 1,500 soldiers, you know, it's like what happened in Vietnam. Well, we have advisors there. We're sending advisors. Well, those advisors eventually is a full-fledged war. There are some feelings of, really? This is what the Statue of Liberty does here? Is the Statue of Liberty dressed in camouflage now? You know, what happened to those fleeing death and destruction, violence, famine, you know, coming to the shores of the land of the free? It's unreal. A Democratic government, a Democratic White House, you know, mobilizing troops to these people, this group of people that are coming who are fleeing horrible violence and death and hunger, you know, fleeing, you know, their lands that were destroyed, you know, during the 1980s under the Reagan administration and all of that. I mean, it's unreal. We destroyed those lands. Now those people, a lot of those are people that were left behind, children that were left behind when there was a massive fleeing from that violence back in the 80s. We saw that. Well, here we are, the children of those that fled, now in their 30s and 40s, themselves fleeing with their own children, hungry. They can't work the lands anymore. Some of those lands have been completely corporatized, and the conglomerates have come in, you know, for more coffee, more bananas, more pineapples, more tropical foods. Really? And, of course, you know, the shipping of drugs, you know, from Colombia and other areas in Sudamerica. But the thing I think that's really important, and it's really something we really need to look at, is the human face here. These are hungry people fleeing cold, fleeing, you know, all of that, coming to the United States that should have its doors open. The Biden administration promised, you know, Joe Biden himself, 2 weeks before he got elected to the presidency, made some promises. One of them, he had a four-point agenda. One of those 4 points was immigration reform. That was a ploy to get the Latino vote to vote for him. Without the Latino vote, you know, his administration is in trouble, and they know it. You know, they can get all the Hispanic votes, but they're not going to get, you know, the Latino, indigenous, Chicano votes this time around. This is how they respond to immigration reform, sending troops to the border. The world sees it as an act of aggression. If Mexico wasn't bought out, the presidency of Mexico wasn't bought out by the U.S., you know, there would be demonstrations, there would be protests. Why are you amassing troops on the border? Are you going to invade the country? That's been a thought in the background. But today, during Cinco de Mayo, today, during this week of the really consciously mourning the loss of indigenous women, you know, throughout, you know, the Americas, and this, particularly when it comes to the U.S. borders in Canada and the U.S. borders with Mexico. It's crazy, but it's reality. So what do we do here? How can we stop this? You know, I mean, how do we?
Those are the questions. Those are definitely the questions, and they really need to be answered. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. You've been listening to Miguel Gavilán Molina. Also joining us is our good friend Francisco Herrera. And we're talking about, well, now it's Cinco de Mayo, but we're talking about the fact that there are 1,500 troops at the border. And this, they're saying these troops are unarmed. Well, then why are they sending the military? The military fights wars generally. So does it mean they're unarmed, but they have the guns in the trucks, Francisco?
And it's active duty. They're sending 1,500 active duty soldiers. You expect us really to believe they're going to come do data entry? It's ridiculous what is going on in the sense of militarizing the border. This country's economic plan, business plan is war. And I want to underline something that Gavilan, that you said. The human face, you know, at the ground level, there's thousands of people, millions, I would even say, of people who are happy to support. I couldn't believe going to Arizona a couple of years back in this one community where they were saying, you know, we were happy, we were fine, we had a cross-border community here, no fence, people going back and forth, and the immigration came and destroyed the whole relationship of people that we had. It's not too far from Tucson's community. And there's hundreds of thousands of people who are happy with this situation. It's the circus that's been created around this whole attacking of Latin Americans because, you know, the European American elites realize that they're not a majority anymore and want to raise the whole racist issue. It's really amazing, and really it's a call to our peoples to condemn what's going on with this circus of sending 1,500 active duty soldiers. You know, it's like they're not going to do the data entry. It's like Gavilan said, you know, we saw it in Vietnam. We saw it in El Salvador. You know, we saw it in Honduras. Oh, we're just sending, what was it called? What did you, advisors? But the fact of the matter, everyone could see they were bringing drugs from creating the crack epidemic. Now they've moved all their drug trade to Haiti, and we've got the havoc that's going on there, and then sending arms and sending killers. So it's this whole thing is very dangerous, what they've set up, and we should be condemning and filling the phone lines of the Washington White House saying we do not approve, we condemn the situation, just like we did back in the 80s, and we forced the government to stop funding genocidal Guatemalan government. We forced the government to disband their attack on Nicaragua through Honduras. These things that we won are never really told, but we won them. We stopped these massive killings, and we have to do it again.
Amazing. That's Francisco Herrera. You know, as you talk about this, and I've mentioned this before, but I spent close to a year in Tucson and Nogales covering a major trial of sanctuary workers. And the thing that I learned, I'd go to a wedding on the Nogales side of the border and then the reception on the U.S. side of the border. That the relations and the relationships and the the quality of life was a part of the cross-country communication. And the policy back from Clinton, I mean, Clinton put it into writing, the policy was we're going to end that, we're going to punish people, we're going to make it extremely difficult, it's going to be so punishing, so life-threatening that they're not going to try it. And that's been the policy ever since.
But no one's going to stop a people that are starving and doing everything they can to survive. It's baloney. All they did was a crime against humanity of gatekeeper creating these blocks so that people were forced to go through the most dangerous part of the desert and die. And that hasn't stopped them, and it's not going to stop them, because this is a people's movement of people saying, U.S. policy has destroyed our lands, you burnt our house down, and we're coming over here to move further away from the violence that you have created. It's not a war against drugs. It's a drug war against people. And you could see it, Coca-Cola murdering union leaders in Colombia. You could see it in Mexico when social leaders are completely massacred and murdered, and it's called part of the drug war. It's the same stunt that they did in Vietnam with Nixon and Cambodia. It's the same thing. It's a drug war against people, and people are organizing. That's what they're doing. That's what the 1,500 troops represent at the border today.
Gavilan.
It's just heartbreaking, you know, because it's a celebration, and here we have the Biden administration promising 2 years ago to, you know, reform immigration to allow people to come in. We saw people come in, but they're not of the right color. Brown people aren't welcome in this country, particularly from south of the border. And like I said, it's disheartening because the answer, really, Joe, you're going to need the Latino vote. He's going to need the Chicano vote, you know, come, you know, 2 years from now, the national elections. And all those Democrats that are basically Demopublicans, because, you know, they haven't, they don't have the spine, you know, to take on the Trumplican GOP party. And here we are, you know, the disgrace to, you know, the Statue of Liberty. You know, those words, you know, welcome, you know, the hungry, you know, the starving, the cold, just unreal. I mean, there is no more welcome for brown people, indigenous people. And but here in this country, it is a country that depends on brown labor, and particularly here in California. So, per 5 de Mayo, again, I drop down to a knee and address and salute all the indigenous women that have kept our peoples alive, and thoughts and prayers to those that have been the victims of violence. But here in this country, during Cinco de Mayo, you know, and soldiers at the border, it's what this country is about. It's war and destruction. And look at it here in the United States. No one is safe anymore. The land of the free is now the land of the fear. You know, the land of, you know, free, liberty, and justice for all. There is no justice for us. And liberty, are you kidding me? Under the Biden or the Trumplican parties, there is no liberty for brown people, indigenous peoples. So, as Francisco says, these are the time where we come together, forge a united national pride day of honoring our indigenous women and again, honoring our peoples that have survived and that have made California the empire of agriculture on earth. We farm workers, we indigenous slaving in the fields. So for all of those and people that celebrate humanity, I ask you to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Join us in forging a new consciousness, a new country where all worlds are possible, where we can all embrace each other, not, you know, go into a tolerance, but we want acceptance. You know, people that come here, that migrate here, they don't come for handouts. They don't come, you know, to rip off this country. They come to contribute. They come to give their children a chance, because in their homelands, it was destroyed by the United States foreign military policy. And this is the answer on Cinco de Mayo that the Biden administration gives to hungry, starving, cold people fleeing the violence that United States is responsible for. So that said, I hope the Statue of Liberty at some point is looked upon. If not, she should be dismantled, because at this point it doesn't apply for the masses of refugees seeking asylum. Que viva Cinco de Mayo and the spirit of resistance.
Francisco, yeah, you get the last couple of minutes.
Just to take the baton from Gavilan, may that spirit really strengthen our hearts and our brains and our minds to work together to do what our ancestors have done. Resistance flourish, work, organize. We're growing in numbers, and we'll continue to grow, and we continue to need to organize, bring back all our stories, bring back our traditions in new ways, because now we're a whole mix of so many folks, but we are all working people. And I think that's the magic for me of Cinco de Mayo. Working folks, regular folks, defeated the most powerful army of that time, and all those arms are not gonna stop the damage that U.S. foreign policy has created. U.S. foreign policy has burned the house of our neighbor, and the appropriate thing to do out of obligation is to open the doors, process people, and continue growing.
Absolutely. That's Francisco Herrera. Before that was our good friend Miguel Gavilan Molina. They work with me on Flashpoints. Francisco is a significant tribute to a globally known, we love him in this hemisphere, and it's always a treasure and a treat to have you, Francisco, along with Miguel, to talk about this kind of stuff. We got a big job ahead of all of us, and we have to continue to keep our eyes on the prize. I thank you both for joining us for Cinco de Mayo, and there'll obviously, there's going to be a lot more to come. So as they say in the Native American community, aho. And now we're going to say goodbye.
Wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Radio is hiring. We are currently accepting applications for the position of Membership Coordinator. The Membership Coordinator is responsible for planning and developing KBOO's fundraisers and on-air membership drives, data entry, working with major donors, direct mail campaigns, and community outreach. This position is 25 hours per week. For the full job description and instructions for applying, go to our website at kboo.fm/membership-hire or send your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org. Applications are due by midnight, Friday, May 19th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
Tune into KBOO on Saturday, May 20th from 5